Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Elon Musk is taking his electric car company and going home. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 7th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Elon Musk. Never shy. We've had him on the program a couple of times. Always says what he thinks. And at 9:48 this morning, West Coast time, because that's where Tesla is. Enough of this anti-West Coast bias, thank you. Musk said this in a tweet to his 22 million-something followers. Am considering taking Tesla private at $420, funding secured. Now, a couple of things. First of all, that's $420 a share. Second of all, whoa. And third of all, that am considering line in a tweet to, as I said, 22 million people. 3 hours, one halt in trading of Tesla shares, and a statement from Musk on the Tesla website later. We know what's going on. As far as Musk is concerned, pending a shareholder vote, this thing is a done deal. He's kind of had it, as we've reported a couple of times the past month or two, with the scrutiny that comes with being a publicly traded company, especially one that's had some very publicized problems hitting production targets for its make or break Model 3. Left unclear is the big question. You're going to take a company private. You're going to have to raise a whole boatload of money, certainly for Tesla, in the tens of billions of dollars. No clue from Musk today, in tweets or otherwise, of where he is going to get that cash that he said was confirmed. Now, if all this works out the way Musk hopes, he's going to be able to get more of those all-important Model 3s on the road faster, which means more consumers are going to have to get used to how to use them. Jeff Fowler wrote about the car and some of the issues it presents for the Washington Post. Jeff, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, you sit down in the Model 3 for the first time. What's it like? Give us the vibe.
You look around and all you really see is one giant iPad looking thing right there in the middle. In fact, the first time I got into the Model 3, the radio was already on and it was blaring. And my buddy and I, who had just ordered it and had just arrived, we wanted to talk, but we couldn't hear each other. And so we were looking around trying to figure out, how do we turn off the radio? And believe it or not, and I am a professional gadget guy, I could not figure out how to turn down the radio. After about a minute of scrambling, I finally figured out if you repeatedly press in one corner, the volume would go down. But it was a sign of things to come.
Well, so let's go to that place where things are coming from. Part of the scrolling you did to find the volume knob, the virtual volume knob, I guess, was that you found this thing's privacy settings. And that's why I wanted to get you on the phone, because as you say in this piece, this is basically an iPhone in terms of its connectivity.
Indeed. There's a lot of really big questions, but of course, the stakes are higher here because this is a moving vehicle. And in that, you mentioned the privacy policy. That was one of the first signals to me as well. So you tap around on the screen for a while, and you eventually get to this screen, and it looks a little bit like the privacy settings on Facebook. And it says, oh, by the way, by default, Tesla is going to take video recordings of everywhere you drive, and also information about where you go. Now, you can turn that off. They give you the option, thankfully, but there's also a microphone in the car, for example. That can be amazing. It can be used to talk with your car like you might do Siri or Alexa. Mm. It could even be used to diagnose problems in the car just by letting the Tesla folks remotely listen in to hear if there are problems there. But it could also be turned on, you know, to hear your private conversations.
Okay, but look, just to continue with the iPhone comparison here for a minute. When iPhones came out, we were all, oh man, this is whiz-bang and amazing, and look at all this stuff I can do. And of course, there's an app for that. And now people are backing off a little bit saying, wait, maybe it's not so great that we're staring at our screens all the time. Maybe it's not so great that we're connected all the time. In 10 years, when the Model 3 is in theory everywhere, or whoever has ripped off its version of it, are we going to be doing the same thing?
I think so. And that's exactly the point of my piece, that maybe we need to start having that conversation now instead of waiting in 10 years. And to me, the biggest challenge, the one that I think is most pressing that we really need to figure out now, is the distraction question. Yeah. So now we're having a lot of questions about, you know, oh, is my iPhone, you know, making me lose sleep, or is it turning my children into zombies? Well, the research that's happened so far have shown that these touchscreen interfaces in cars are very distracting and put a pretty high cognitive load on drivers. The problem is with Tesla, you have to interact with this thing while you're on the road. It hides some pretty critical parts of the car, of the function of the car. If you want to move the mirrors, you gotta click in there. If you want to change the air conditioning, you gotta tap in there. If you even want to open the glove box, you've got to tap in there. There's no handle for the glove box on its own.
That's nutty, man, that you have to do that, because, I mean, right? Keep your eyes on the road.
So, you know, I would think that Tesla really ought to be foregrounding how they're designing this interface to be safer, but they're not really. And in fact, last week, Elon Musk tweeted that he wanted to hire video game developers to develop games for that center panel. And I was like, this is not inspiring trust in this car and in the direction that this company is going to take us all.
Jeff Fowler, he's a tech reporter for The Washington Post, writing about the car that is an iPhone in many, many ways, the Tesla Model 3. Jeff, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
You bet.
By the time the dust cleared on Wall Street today, Tesla shares were up 11%. Musk, who owns 20% of the company, was plus or minus $1 billion richer. And as to whether that tweet broke any laws, SEC Regulation FD is the one you want to read. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to continue with a theme here, that theme being companies and then buying their own shares. To be clear, because there are a whole lot of moving parts in that Tesla story, as I said, that's not a stock buyback. That's just plain going private, leaving the public market. But there is some analysis out from Goldman Sachs that stock buybacks, which is companies buying back from shareholders a certain number of shares short of fully going private, that those buybacks at S&P 500 companies are on track to hit $1 trillion this year. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains what happens when that happens.
When a company buys up some of its own stock, that takes shares off the market, making each one more valuable. Sarah Anderson is Global Economy Director at the Institute for Policy Studies.
Because of the law of supply and demand, that boosts their stock price, and that makes their shareholders happy, and it makes their executives happy.
Now, stock buybacks aren't a new trend. Charles Wang at Harvard Business School says they've been on the rise for a while. The most obvious reason?
Simply because corporations are making more and more money over time.
But there could be something else behind this recent jump in buybacks. The federal government just cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21%. Annette Nellen is a tax professor at San Jose State University.
Many companies know that they will be owing less federal tax and then deciding what will we do with the funds, and the stock buyback might make sense.
There are other things companies could be doing with their tax cuts, like hiring workers or raising wages. Is that stuff happening? Charles Wang at Harvard says it's too soon to say for sure.
Unemployment is declining, so companies are hiring more employees. And we have seen wages go up. Now, whether or not that is a result of the tax cut per se, that's a very difficult question to answer.
He says stock buybacks wouldn't necessarily stop companies from making other investments. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
There is news today of immigration and the social safety net, who uses it and what might happen to them if they do. NBC News is reporting that the White House wants to make it harder for legal immigrants, that is legal immigrants who've used government benefits, to become citizens. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports that immigrants who might be a drain on this economy have never been warmly welcomed in this country. But the Trump administration is considering even tighter restrictions.
Right now, if the government thinks that potential immigrants are going to be primarily dependent on the government, those immigrants won't be let in. Can't get a visa, can't get a green card. It's been that way for a long time.
In the 19th century, when this rule was first created, it really only targeted people who were wards of the state.
David Beer is with the Cato Institute. Wards of the state, people who've been institutionalized, received cash assistance, lived in subsidized housing, those folks get turned away. Under the reported new proposal, here's all it would take.
Use of any benefits at all at any level of government, including by U.S. citizen family members of the immigrant.
This covers a lot of benefits, not just benefits for people in poverty. Mark Greenberg is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute.
Medicaid, children's health insurance, refundable earned income tax credits.
Even, he says, enrolling in a subsidized health plan under Obamacare could disqualify a legal immigrant under the reported proposal. This has some legal immigrants very worried. Lena Kandvala is an attorney with the Legal Aid Society.
We've had people, you know, disenrolling their children from Head Start programs because they're afraid that it's going to preclude them from applying for permanent resident status.
According to the Migration Policy Institute, under the old rules, about 3% of non-citizens in the U.S. could be disqualified from getting a visa or a green card. Under the new proposal reportedly being considered, 47% could be disqualified. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Why would they build the largest cricket platform here? I don't know.
Yeah, no, me neither, man. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 0.5% today, 126 points, 25,628. The S&P 500 inched up almost 0.3%, 8 points. Finished the session at 2858. The NASDAQ also added 0.3%, 23 points, 78.83. Energy stocks powered up today. Marathon Petroleum gushed 1.8% higher. Valero added more than 1.5%. ExxonMobil pumped up 1.3%. Goldman Sachs led the charge in financials, adding 0.8%. Morgan Stanley banked gains of 0.3%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.97%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know that thing where people say the news slows down in August? Yeah, I don't know which August they're talking about, but it's not this one. There was Tesla this morning, politics, because, of course, also the video streaming industry. This morning, Jeffrey Katzenberg of DreamWorks Animation fame and former Hewlett-Packard CEO Meg Whitman announced they had raised a cool $1 billion for their new mobile video startup. The pair are not the first, and almost certainly won't be the last to get into that video streaming space, but there's a lot going on here. Brooks Barnes covers the business of Hollywood for the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
I don't know what your take was as you read this news today about Katzenberg and Meg Whitman and new TV. Mine was, man, another streaming service?
It's starting to get expensive, or it's going to be right? Very soon, right?
Is there room, I guess, is maybe the beginning question.
Well, they're making room. I mean, the Katzenberg news has been kind of coming for a very long time, and we don't really know too many specifics about when and what that might look like. Basically, he said, we think that there's a demand for a subscription app that pumps out short form, up to 10 minutes long content. Our distinguishing factor is that it's going to be high quality, not YouTube. There's some questions about whether that is needed or wanted.
Yeah.
Quality doesn't seem to really matter too much on Twitter and YouTube. And
right.
You know,
right. Yeah, no, that's totally true. You mentioned YouTube. I was going to go with another company, which is Netflix, which seems to be sort of the 800-pound gorilla here, right? And everybody's coming at Netflix and wanting to get into that market. Netflix is going to spend like $10 billion-ish on content this coming year, and it kind of does make $1 billion for Katzenberg and Whitman kind of pale in comparison.
It kind of makes your jaw drop every time Netflix says a new number that they're spending on, and Amazon Prime is not far behind. Yeah, Netflix has 130 million subscribers globally now, and just, I think, 4 years ago, it was at about 12 million. And so what we're seeing is the legacy media companies, the giants, Disney, Comcast, they're all now saying, especially Disney, the time of protecting our legacy businesses, our ESPN affiliate fees, and you know, the traditional television business, that's over. And we've got to maintain that business because it's huge still, but we're also going to go full bore on streaming because the pendulum has swung.
So speaking of Disney, since you brought it up, true confession time, the reason we originally had you scheduled to come on was to talk about the article you wrote the other day about Disney's new streaming service, and then this Katzenberg thing breaks this morning, and we rolled it all into one. But speaking of legacy media companies, right, Disney is arguably the biggest, the best known, the broadest, and it now has its own streaming service. It's got a slice of Hulu, and it's going to be in Katzenberg. It seems like they're just doing whatever it takes. They got a lot of money, and they're throwing it around, and they're saying, we're going to see what works.
Yeah, the Katzenberg thing, all the studios have a little money in that. The main projects Disney is working on, they just launched an ESPN streaming. What's coming next is a service they haven't named, but some people are calling it Disneyflix, which is going to be Marvel, Disney-branded content and Disney's library, sort of a family Netflix.
A word here about audiences, right? Because everybody obviously is betting that the audiences are going to be there, but it does seem that they are slicing it, and this is a trend, right? Slicing it finer and finer and finer and finer.
What's interesting is that they're rebuilding the cable system in some ways, right? Like, you know, people don't want to pay a ton of money to subscribe to these packages. But the more and more, to your point, is that, you know, it's like, it's looking a little like the cable dial. But I guess the difference is people can decide what they want to subscribe to rather than paying it all in bulk.
Brooks Barnes writes for the New York Times. Brooks, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Google, as we all know, likes to do big things. Whether they actually do get those things done, though, is a more complicated question. Remember 3-4 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, actually, the company announced it was going to start rolling out really high-speed internet service via fiber optic line, something like 50 times faster than the national broadband average. Well, as Jim Burris reports now from WABE in Atlanta, the announcing went fine. The doing was harder.
Jeffrey Welch raises his index finger and points toward the crown molding in his Atlanta condo.
Google comes in up here in the ceiling, and there's a very invisible fiber optic that runs right along the
top. A cable carrying a single strand of fiber optic glass about the width of a human hair runs down the wall and connects to a white plastic box about the size of an electrical outlet. And that's where Google Fiber is supposed to come to life. A Google work crew wired Welch's building in the spring of 2017, but he still doesn't have service.
I can wait because I have good service with Comcast, right? I'm not desperate. But, you know, at some point in time, I'm just going to give up, right?
It's going on 4 years since Google vowed to rewire the region. The promise back then, boost economic development and help bridge the digital divide between the technology haves and have-nots. But so far, that has not happened. Google won't say how many of the roughly 400,000 homes in 9 cities with the potential to get the service actually have it. But federal data and Google Fiber's own mapping show it's a tiny fraction of that.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us today. My name is
It
Tom.
Wasn't supposed to be this way.
The bottom line is that Google Fiber is coming to the Atlanta metropolitan region.
In January of 2015, Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed touted Google Fiber's arrival as an unprecedented catalyst for economic development.
Today is one of the most important moments in the life of the Atlanta metropolitan region.
Reed is now out of office and didn't return requests for comment, but it's easy to see why he was so optimistic.
We've always been a crossroads.
In this ad, Google Fiber is pitched as something more than just an internet provider. It's a force for social unity.
It'll help bring us even closer together.
Atlanta and the other cities raced to facilitate the rollout any way they could. One mayor told a local blog the service would be available in 2 years. Google Fiber's website said the wait could be, quote, several months. Initially, that prediction looked reasonable. engineers designed a ring of fiber around the Atlanta area that feeds into 20 or so fiber huts. From there, the fiber snakes through rows of switches, amplifiers, and other equipment before embarking on the last mile to customers' homes. This fiber hut rests on a freshly poured concrete slab in the suburb of East Point. The structure is about the size of a one-car garage. It's set here, unused, for more than a year now. Google has never said publicly when it would complete the rollout. A review of hundreds of emails, internal memos, and other correspondence show Google Fiber was careful not to make such promises. Still, it came as a surprise when Google essentially pumped the brakes on the project last year.
In our view, when we have something that is substantively enough...
At a technology conference earlier this year, Ruth Porat, the CFO of Google Fiber's parent company, Alphabet, said the rollout was on pause until the project's value proposition shifted. That's corporate jargon for, we're losing too much money. In a statement, Google Fiber said it's still committed to connecting consumers in Atlanta to, quote, super-fast internet and the opportunities it affords. While Google Fiber stumbled in its rollout, rivals like Comcast and AT&T quickly expanded their networks to offer faster speeds with no indefinite wait. But in a way, Google still wins. It makes money putting ads in front of consumers, so more bandwidth and faster connections mean Google can do that more efficiently, no matter who is providing the connection. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Cricket is the second most popular sport in the world behind soccer. We don't really talk about it a lot in this country, what with our version of the game and all, baseball. But there is a businessman in Texas who is hoping to change the way we think about cricket and that if he builds it, people will come. Marketplace's Andy Euler went out to Prairie View, Texas to take a look-see.
Drive out west to Houston and you see mostly undeveloped cornfields on either side of the highway. It's probably the last place you'd expect to see a billboard hawking the largest cricket complex in the USA in a town of 6,000 called Prairie View. But it's there I meet Tanwir Ahmed.
So as you can see here, it's a development of about close to 88 acres.
Land that Ahmed spent millions of his own dollars to acquire. He grew up poor in Pakistan, saving pennies for cricket gear. He moved to the United States in the late 1980s. Today, he owns more than 150 Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and KFC franchises, plus an energy firm, a medical research venture, and the construction company that's building these fields.
It was a dream project, yes. I'm just hoping and keeping my fingers crossed that I would be able to complete it.
The first four fields are set to be finished by September. Still, why here? Prairie View, a small college town in the middle of East Texas.
This is right on the freeway. People drive by, I think there are about like 50,000 cars a day. And if you really want to introduce to the school level, people, they need to see us playing here.
Ahmed wants to start a cricket academy on the property to attract kids and their parents. He says he'll start by promoting to the South Asian community he knows already enjoys the game. And that population, the area, is booming. Between 2000 and 2012, Pakistani immigrants in Greater Houston grew by almost 75%, and transplants from India, 87%. Many of them are already part of amateur cricket clubs.
Every person that we met here in Prairie View, they were very excited. They're very, very friendly, very cooperative, and they're excited to have us here.
Including the town's mayor, David Allen, who's agreed to help the development with promotion, even money out of his budget. He says anything to widen the tax base here is a blessing.
And that's how I view it, as bringing individuals into our city and the need for additional development, things like hotels, additional places to eat, and all the things that go with those type of activities.
But Alan says he's into the project for other reasons.
I plan to learn how to play cricket myself.
Some residents are skeptical. About a mile down the road at Las Fuentes Mexican Restaurant, a pair of locals are drinking beers after work. They run concrete for oil rigs in the area. I asked Garrett Holloway what he thinks of the new development.
Why would they build the largest cricket platform here? I don't know. Because we're in Texas, and especially around here, it's football, baseball.
But his buddy, Max McConnell, says Prairie View should be happy with any development it can get.
I know the town well enough by living here to know that it's not a very wealthy community, and anything that would bring people out here definitely couldn't hurt the community.
And whether they like it or not, Prairie View is becoming part of the Houston metropolitan area fast. A new turnpike and highway expansion means folks from Houston can get here in 45 minutes. That could mean higher property values and more wealth in the community. It could also mean more international residents and visitors. People Tanwer Ahmed is hoping will turn his dream project into a global destination for cricket. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I think I did this last year, maybe the year before, I forget. But either way, it can't be said often enough. Today is Black Women's Equal Pay Day. This, that is August, is how far into 2018 a black woman had to work to make what a white man made in 2017. Just going to leave that there. We got to go. Dow Industrial's up about 0.5% today, 126. That's in points. S&P 500 inched up almost 0.3%. That is 8 points. NASDAQ up 0.3 as well, 23 points. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.